The time is now. Volume 1, Episode 4. This is Employment Law Now. Thanks very much for coming back to listen. I'm Mike Schmidt, your host for this podcast and the Vice Chair of the Labor and Employment Department at Cozen O'Connor. I have some interesting things to talk to you about in this episode. I'll start with an update from Washington, D.C., give you a couple of noteworthy cases that I think are worth following and worth knowing about, a significant trend that's spreading across the country, and even a new segment for this podcast. There also may be, as a very special event, an Eddie Murphy and a Cuba Gooding Jr. sighting. You'll find out what I mean in just a little while, but let's get started first with our Update Now segment. Very briefly, I told you in the last episode that President Trump had nominated Alex Acosta for the cabinet position of Secretary of the United States Department of Labor. Things seem to be moving somewhat more quickly with this particular nomination, and his Senate confirmation hearing is scheduled to take place on March 15th. So I'll keep you posted on what's going on in D.C. and how things are going with Mr. Acosta's confirmation. As I said last time as well, he appears to be much more of a mainstream candidate, or nominee, I should say, while still being very much pro-employer in his leanings and what his likely agenda would be at the Department of Labor. But I'll keep you posted on that. Let's move to our Noteworthy Now segment, and there are two very noteworthy cases that I think are really important to your company. The first is in the area of whistleblowing for financial fraud that an employee believes the company is committing. This tends to take place under the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which is also known as SOX, as well as the Dodd-Frank Act. There's been a bit of a divide with courts over whether financial fraud whistleblowers must report their concerns outside of the company to a government agency, here in this case the SEC, in order to be protected as a whistleblower. Some courts have found that you must go outside to the SEC, and it seems that lately courts are tending to go the other way. Here in a very recent case, the Ninth Circuit held, no, a whistleblower doesn't have to go outside the company to report his or her concerns before engaging in what's called protected activity as a whistleblower. The case is Somers versus Digital Realty Trust, Inc., again out of the Ninth Circuit out west. Here you had a vice president who apparently reported possible securities law violations to upper management at the company before he was fired, but he had not yet reported any of his suspicions to the SEC before he was fired. The court found that he was still protected under the anti-retaliation provisions of Dodd-Frank. As the Second Circuit Court of Appeals had similarly held recently, and in contrast to some other courts, the Ninth Circuit here in Somers said that whistleblower protections do extend to those making internal disclosures of alleged unlawful activity under SOX and Dodd-Frank. You don't need to go outside to an agency. So from a takeaway standpoint, do you take, as a company, allegations of a whistleblower very seriously, even if there is no external complaint that was made and brought to your attention? Are you taking these internal complaints seriously enough? And when you break that tree down a little bit more, are you taking the internal complaints seriously enough, whether they are made in person or in writing, or you may find out about them through social media? Are you taking whistleblower allegations seriously enough at your company when it's only been an internal complaint being made? And secondly, does your company have an adequate complaint procedure to appropriately address and resolve employee complaints, both from a process standpoint as well as from the standpoint of who is in charge of doing the investigation and making sure that internal complaints are being handled properly? So that's the Somers case. The second noteworthy now case that I want to talk to you about involves FMLA abuse under the Family Medical Leave Act. This is really a significant issue, and it's one that I'm going to get into a little bit more in a future episode. What happens when your company truly believes that an employee is abusing FMLA? In other words, he or she claims that he has a terrible back condition, and now you learn about or you see pictures of this individual playing softball games during the time that he or she is supposed to be out on FMLA leave. So what happens when you truly believe that the employee is abusing FMLA, you fire the employee for it, but then it turns out that you were wrong in your belief. You were wrong in the underlying facts that prompted the termination. Well, in this second case, your company may still be protected from an FMLA retaliation claim if your belief was an honest belief, and that's going to be the key here. The case is out of the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. It's Caps versus Mondelez Global. Here, the plaintiff, the employee, operated a dough mixing machine for the company and developed a medical condition that he said led to severe flare-ups, very painful flare-ups that required intermittent time off under the FMLA. Now, fast forward a little bit through the facts of the decision. Apparently, on one of the absences where the individual was not able to work because of these flare-ups, the employee allegedly went out to a pub, got intoxicated, was pulled over, and then was arrested for driving under the influence.
Is there a problem, officers?
Well, HR learned about it and determined that the arrest date and the subsequent court dates apparently seemed to fall on the same dates that this employee was supposed to be out on FMLA intermittent leave. So, of course, based on that belief, the company terminated his employment. Unfortunately, it was later determined that HR may have gotten some of the facts a little bit wrong. Maybe the employee was not actually engaging in some personal related conduct during the days that he was supposed to be out on intermittent leave. So the employee sued. The company, after some time in the litigation, filed a motion for summary judgment to dismiss the FMLA retaliation claim, and the court granted the motion, dismissing the FMLA retaliation claim. Since the FMLA retaliation case requires proof of some retaliatory intent, in other words, there's got to be an intent to have retaliated against this individual for taking FMLA leave, that retaliation case, the court said, can be defeated if the intent is instead shown to be an honest belief that the employee was abusing the FMLA, even if that belief turns out to be wrong, even if the belief is based on facts that turn out to be wrong later on. Now, it's important to note that it can't just be a blanket stated belief. You've got to be able to show that the company honestly held that belief based on some evidence that it had to support it. So the good news and the good takeaway here from this Third Circuit case in Caps is that if you can show that there is an honest belief, you can totally defeat an FMLA retaliation claim, even if you end up being wrong. So, do you have a policy addressing dishonesty in employee actions, particularly when it comes to leave? One of the things the company was able to rely on in this Caps case was the fact that the employee acknowledged receiving and reviewing a policy that was entitled a dishonest acts policy. And that's really what the company relied on here. So do you have some sort of policy in your handbook or otherwise addressing dishonesty in employee conduct? Again, particularly when it comes to leave. If you do, it may be easier to rely on this honest belief defense. Next, I want to move to the Trending Now segment. Trending Now segment with a real interesting trend that also may impact your company moving forward if it hasn't already. You know, we've talked a lot about regulations that are sweeping across the country that aim to protect employees in the area of work-life balance, whether we're talking about increases in minimum wage, overtime exemption changes, paid family and sick leave. you hear about and you read a lot about regulations on the state level, in particular across the country, being very pro-employee, trying to preserve employee work-life balance. The next one that I think is a trend that you should keep an eye on is referred to as predictive scheduling. Predictive scheduling, and I love these new terms as we come up with new regulations and new trends. You have all these great new employment law buzzwords and lingo. Predictive scheduling is one of the new ones. There's another great word that I'm going to get to in a minute. It's called clopenings. Clopenings, C-L-O-P-E-N-I-N-G-S. I'm going to get to that one in a minute. It's another great new word to add to your employment law dictionary. But back to this predictive scheduling issue. This is the latest in the new employment trends that I think you need to become familiar with. On the surface, it does seem like it's another reason or another ability for employees to sue employers and simply just try to get money from them.
Show me the money.
But it may not just be about the money at the end of the day. Predictive scheduling and this movement was prompted mostly by employee complaints in such industries as retail, hospitality, fast food, and other predominantly service industries. The irony, I think, to me, is that these industries really tend to offer workers somewhat of a more flexible schedule than the regular 9-to-5 office job. However, that's not what the employees are claiming, and that's not what really prompted this predictive scheduling movement. So while this new area of regulation does seem to be another form of the government regulating an employer's day-to-day business operations, others on the employee side would say that erratic scheduling really wreaks havoc on those who try to have some certainty in their work life and makes it real difficult for them to juggle their work life and family balance issues. So what is predictive scheduling? It's a new set of rules that seek to provide employees with greater certainty about how many hours they're going to work and when. In 2014, San Francisco became the first jurisdiction in the country to pass predictive scheduling laws to address this issue. And that has now become a trend because other cities, other jurisdictions around the country are following suit, and I predict that many more are going to continue to follow San Francisco's lead as we go through 2017 and in future years. Earlier this year, Seattle passed a law that's effective this coming July that will apply, for example, to full-service restaurants, big retailers, and other types of companies in various industries. And earlier just this month, on March 3rd, 2017, the New York City Council passed a series of bills to provide predictive scheduling rules for workers in the fast food industry, as well as in certain retail operations. The laws in the various states do and will vary, but they have similar components to them. For example, the laws here tend to address the minimum number of hours that employees are required to get. For newly hired employees, some of these laws make it a requirement that employers provide a good faith estimate of the expected hours and the expected schedule that the new hires are going to have to work. A third component of these laws deals with posting of schedules, and contain a requirement that schedules have to be posted X number of days or weeks ahead of time. Some laws provide, for example, that schedules have to be posted 2 weeks in advance. Some require 72 hours in advance, but it's this concept of posting schedules ahead of time that is really common in these laws. A fourth component deals with the compensation aspect, the consequence of failing to comply with these posted schedules. Again, on that wreak havoc concern, what if the schedule changes? What if you're called in and you've got to be sent home early? What if we posted 72 hours ahead of time, but 24 hours we make a change? Well, some of these laws require certain compensation to be paid to the employee if there is a change in the previously posted schedule. And then fifth is this great new word that I mentioned a couple of minutes ago, clopenings. Clopenings. As you probably figured out for yourself, clopenings is a word that combines closing and opening. Clopenings. And what it does is it prohibits requiring an employee to close for the night and then reopen the very next morning. In other words, back-to-back shifts where the employee is on the last closing shift one night and the early morning shift the very next morning. And in some cases, if there is not an outright prohibition of that, there might be some compensation component where the employee is required to be compensated extra, whether it's time and a half or double time, if they do have a clopening in their schedule. Again, I love employment law is so big on acronyms, we're now adding all kinds of great new words to our employment law dictionary. So stay abreast in your state and your jurisdiction. You may be in a state where they have already come up with a predictive scheduling piece of legislation, or you may be in a state or jurisdiction where it's something that's being debated now and maybe something that comes down the pike as a new law. But you should be keeping abreast of what's going on where you have your company operations. I think this is a trend worth watching. Some companies, perhaps even in response to the press that we've seen over this issue, have already begun to stop certain scheduling or on-call practices that affect employees negatively, even without legislation already in place. So, again, stay abreast of this issue. We will certainly do our best in this podcast to keep you updated on new laws, new regulations that get passed and become effective in this predictive scheduling trend. Finally, I want to start a new segment on this podcast, which I'm calling Really Now? It's a chance to refer to a particular case or some argument where we don't really need a lot of description here, and perhaps you're just scratching your head or shaking your head and say, really now? So today's case, for purposes of our new segment, it makes you wonder how this one had to go all the way to an appeals court. The case is Heath versus Southern University, and it's a case, again, issued just this month out of the Fifth Circuit. You have a female college professor who was told by an appeals court that she could pursue her harassment and discrimination claims. Notwithstanding the lower court's dismissal of the case, this had to go all the way up to the appeals court, and here's what I took from the decision that appeared to be, I don't know, the smoking gun evidence that got the appeals court to say, no, we're not going to dismiss this. You, female college professor, are allowed to pursue your claims. Apparently, the department chairman allegedly excluded her from meetings on the grounds that he said she talked too much for a woman. She talked too much for a woman. Really now? So that's all for today's episode. Do you have any feedback for me? Are there any topics or outside guests that you want to hear? Do you have any kind of comment about what you've heard so far? All of our episodes, including our past episodes, are available on iTunes, but they're also available on our dedicated website where you can leave comments of any kind, www.employmentlawnow.com. How easy is that? Employmentlawnow.com. Until next time, I really appreciate you listening, and I hope all of your labor is productive.